Welcome everyone, people I've known and people who are new. So I'm going to tell you something about anomalous weak values and contextuality. And just to put this on the table, I am not an expert in anomalous weak values. I did this project mostly to learn about them, and there's exactly two papers I've read on the subject. One of them is mine, and the other one is the one that it's based on. If people know more about anomalous weak values, they should feel free to enlighten the rest of us. So this project sort of started as a collaboration with Matteo Lostaglio. So this is joint work with Matt Pusey and Matteo Lostaglio. And when we started this project, Matteo was sort of interested in essentially studying contextuality in things that he was interested in. So one of the things he's interested in is thermodynamics and fluctuation relations in particular. And so these weak values show up there. But then we did not find a direct connection to sort of some figure of merit in thermodynamics that we could connect to contextuality. But what we did manage to do as a side project, which is kind of the main thing I'm going to talk about now, is how you can sort of use the formalism of noise-robust contextuality, which was proposed by Rob in the year 2005, to essentially be precise about when is an observation of anomalous weak values a signature of non-classicality. Okay, so that's what we are going to sort of build up to and motivate in this talk. Right, so here's a rough outline. So since this talk involves like two components, like anomalous weak values, contextuality, I'm going to give you a sketch of what these different things mean instead of like rather than dwelling too deeply on either one of them, and then give you a sense of what the connection is. Because as I've learned through various talks I've given, it's not a good idea to tell people everything you know, or like, you know, try to do everything in your talk, because then it all ends up being a confusing mess. Or you just don't end up getting to the thing you wanted to say, which is what may be happening right now. But I think I have enough time. That's the structure. Motivation, I'm going to tell you briefly what one means by weak measurements. We'll define what an anomalous weak value is. We'll point out this argument of Matt Pusey, which sort of first showed that anomalous weak values indeed do prove contextuality. And we'll look at some of its limitations, which is what we want to overcome in our work. We want to make the result of the Pusey noise robust, and plus a few other results. So we'll talk about overcoming those limitations, and then I'll tell you what some of the results we have are, and hopefully you'll take away something at the end of this talk. So as I said, the motivation for this talk is when is it surprising that you saw an anomalous weak value? That is, when is it a signature of something non-classical going on? So the genesis of this work, and as well as Pusey's work, goes all the way back to this paper where Aronov, Albert, and Weidman first defined the notion of a weak value. And as you can see from the title, it has this sort of absurd-looking title, which says, you know, how the result of a measurement of a component of the spin of a spin half particle can turn out to be 100. Now, obviously, like if you're just doing straightforward projective measurements, that's not going to happen. You're not going to see something outside the eigenvalue range, so there's something funny going on here. And so that's all in the fine print, right? Like, and the fine print is essentially that they compute the expectation value with respect to a conditional distribution rather than a... in any case, we'll get to that. So this result generated a lot of controversy about like whether it was really surprising, and people built classical models to sort of simulate anomalous weak values. One of the more provocative results was this paper by Chris Ferry and Josh Coombs, where very cheekily they decided to mimic the title of that paper and called it "How the Result of a Single Coin Toss Can Turn Out to Be 100 Heads." And essentially, just to kind of point out that, strictly speaking, mathematically, you can reproduce that phenomenon just classically. And of course, there's like all kinds of all kinds. So the thing is that the feature that they were focused on reproducing was the anomaly in the weak value, and for which they used some disturbance. But the thing is that this is a classical simulation. There's this claim that anomaly is something non-classical, and people try to use them in, I think, various kinds of experimental tasks. I mean, I'm not really very well aware of what are the various kinds of things where they happen to be useful for some amplification schemes and things like that. But I think metrology is one place where people claim advantages. And so Chris and Josh also have another paper, which is essentially arguing against advantages in metrology from anomalous weak values. So here I've written on two. Oh, of course. So then after that, Matt Pusey wrote this paper on when is it that you can actually claim that that witnessing an anomaly is a proof of contextuality. And so it's so here Matt laid down some additional desiderata, which come from the phenomenology of a weak value experiment, that your classical model should also try to respect. And the notion of classicality we work with is non-contextuality, given those some operational features of a weak value experiment. You ask for non-contextuality in your classical model, and then you ask if it's indeed possible to simulate any degree of anomaly in a non-contextual model. And he showed that for a sufficiently large anomaly and a sufficiently weak measurement, you can actually witness contextuality using anomalous weak values. Not always, but like if it's sufficiently anomalous. And so there's a concrete inequality that characterizes that. Now, this paper assumed that the post-selection was projective. It assumed projective measurements. Actually, I haven't described what a weak value experiment is right now, so I'll get to that first. And so what we did was, so roughly speaking, this paper made some assumptions about what features the experiment must satisfy. And some of those features turn out to be very sort of ideal. For example, that the post-selection is projective. Because in the real world, you know, you usually inevitably introduce noise into your measurements. So there will in general, so the theorem is not valid if the post-selection is non-projective. So that's one of the things. That's where we started. And there's a few other things that you can improve upon in this paper. And so this is the new and improved version of that result, where we essentially take like a broad look at like various features of the experiment and you know, what are the operational criteria that you should look at relative to which you'll apply your assumption of non-contextuality, and you should not require that the post-selection is projective in your analysis. Okay, so just for reference, if people want to look at these are like PIRSA identifiers, like Parameter Institute Recorded Seminar Archive. So these are two talks that happen at PI at some point. They're good reference points for some of the discussion here. One of them is actually by Chris Ferry. It was a very provocative talk, and I think Lucien was the one organizing it, and Aharonov was in the audience. And even if you're not interested so much in anomalous weak values, you can just switch to the last 30 minutes for like a showdown. It's like a fun talk to watch. It's one of the more entertaining talks on PIRSA. And the other talk here is a Pi Day talk by Matt Pusey, where he talked about contextuality and anomalous weak values to like everyone at PI. So it's like fairly sort of big picture and a nice talk. So you should definitely look at that. I'll let you figure out which one is which. Like I've forgotten which one is which. So that's just for reference. If you want to look at just the big picture and some gossipy talks. In any case, I was actually in one of these talks, I was in the audience, and like the one with the showdown. And I think later on I found out that if you check carefully, then I'm somewhere at the back in the room, and I'm like two seats behind Aharonov. and I completely forgot that there was like a camera in the room, and I was like recording the interaction. And so there's a video of me recording that interaction as well. In any case, so it was definitely viral worthy. If like physicists rule the world, then like if there was like a lot of physicists in the world, then it'd be a viral video. In any case, it wasn't, but it would be if it. Okay, so a weak value experiment. What do we mean by a weak value experiment? The experiment has three stages. Firstly, so I'm drawing these boxes and these arrows just because in quantum information we used to thinking in this operational sort of way, and I think that's a good way to kind of abstract away from the messy details of the calculations and just look at big picture what's going on. So the first thing is that you prepare a system in some state rho. I don't know if this thing displays. I don't think it displays on this. So you prepare it in some state rho star. This is your pre-selection. You send the system into this box. This does what's called a weak measurement, and it's essentially a channel which has like some quantum output and like a classical read-off, which is this X, okay. And then finally, on the post-measurement state, you'll do some post-selection measurement. So it's like a binary outcome measurement. So it's like either you pass the post-selection or you fail it. And Y denotes whether you succeed or fail. We'll just use Y equals 1 to say that the post-selection succeeds, 0 to say that it fails. And X is just is a real number in the continuum sort of case. It doesn't have to be continuous, but traditionally it's taken to be continuous. In fact, one of our results is that it goes through in the discrete case as well. So this is the scheme you should keep in mind at the back, like every time I'm talking about this expert. This is what's happening. So there's some preparation, there's something going on in between, and then there's a post-selection, right? Okay, so what are weak measurements? So we all know what strong measurements are. They're just like regular projective measurements that we do in the lab. This is like a plus along the z-axis state, for example. You measure the z spin in the z basis, and you obtain plus 1 or minus 1 with equal probability. So that's like you collapse the state into this or that. And so when we say weak measurements, we essentially construct a more elaborate model of what a measurement is. This is like what's called the von Neumann sort of model of, I guess, measurements, where you couple the system to some sort of a read-off device, a pointer on which you look at some readings to infer what the spin is. And so what do we mean by doing this? What we mean is that so the pointer is just a one-dimensional system. It's coupled with your system using this sort of interaction, and the interaction is designed in a way that it couples the X measurements, the position measurements on the pointer. So when you end up on the plus one outcome, when you're centered around the plus one outcome, then you know that you've collapsed your system that your spin read-off there is plus one. And when you're here, then your read-off is minus one. Okay, this is still a strong measurement. So the strength of the measurement here will correspond to the width of this Gaussian. In which you have Gaussian wave packet in which you prepare your original, your pointer state, okay? So weakening this measurement essentially corresponds to using a bigger width for the Gaussian. So you're more uncertain about what the initial position of the pointer is. And this is still a pretty strong measurement because when you do a measurement on this, an X measurement after this interaction, it still resolves like whether it's plus one or minus one pretty well. Like there's a small, these are still sort of non-overlapping, so it's still a relatively good measurement. Now, this one's like fairly strong. I'm just using the terminology that Matt used in his talk. So fairly strong, we mean that, that there is a degree of possible confusion about what the exact outcome is, and it also means that since the measurement is weaker, you're reducing, you're trying to cause as little disturbance to the input state. Okay, so this is still fairly strong. We haven't made it sufficiently weak. Then this is mediocre, like, you know, there's a substantial overlap. But you can see that, you know, the disturbance has kind of reduced. It's shifted back to closer to its initial state. And so you make it even weaker, And now you have weak measurements where basically, you know, you could land anywhere on this. And you will disturb the system very minimally in the post-measurement state. Okay? Okay, so that's just like a brief sort of sketch of what the intuition for what the pointer is doing there. Okay. So weak value. So remember, we were talking about this weak value experiment. It had these three stages. I described only the middle stage, which was the weak measurement. Now, from that, you can compute, including the post selection. So once you do look at the whole experiment, then you can compute something called the weak value of an observable O under. So pre-selection is rho. So I called it rho star initially. So it's the pre-selection rho. And post-selection, let's call it phi. Then the weak value is defined as this quantity, which is the trace of, you know, this pi phi O rho divided by pi phi rho. So this is the overlap of the pre-selection and the post-selection. Okay. So this quantity must be, so they must be non-orthogonal for this to be well-defined. So this quantity cannot be zero. But typically, it's taken to be like very close to orthogonal. This quantity here can, in general, be complex because these two things don't have to commute. Like, this is not a regular expectation value. So this is where the anomaly will be hiding in this expression, right? The denominator is just like a regular probability. And O is the thing of which you want to do a weak measurement, like the weak measurement is a weak measurement of O. Okay, so when do we call a weak value anomalous? So that expression, so let's just expand that expression. So if you knew the spectral resolution of decomposition of O, then you can break it up into like a real and an imaginary part. And and we call the weak value anomalous whenever this quantity, this weak value, is outside the range of the expectation, the spectrum, outside the spectrum of O, the range of possible expectation values of O. And so that means either its real part has to lie outside this, or it has to have a non-zero imaginary part, right? Or both. So EJs are the projectors in the resolution in the spectral decomposition of O. So these are projectors.
And the O little J's are the.
These are the eigenvalues associated with the.
That phi is meant to be a subscript of the expectation.
Yeah, this expression is just compute the weak value using just EJ instead of O.
Right. Okay.
That's what that is. Okay. So yeah, so we'll call it anomalous whenever this quantity is outside of the expectation value range, which can be either due to the real part or the imaginary part. It's just simple algebra. If you note that, you know, that this is a resolution of the identity, then the sum of these things should be one. And so then we can rewrite the condition for anomalous weak values, the fact that it's outside the expectation value range, as this, essentially that if it's outside the expectation value range, then there must exist some J for which the real part gives you a negative expectation value, which is outside 0 and 1 for a projector. And or for the imaginary part, at least one of them has to have to be negative. So this is just from this normalization condition, right? Like the real parts must add up to 1. So if there is an anomalous projector, then it has to have a value greater than 1. Right? But because it has to normalize, there must be something else which has a value less than 1. So there must always be something like this, right? And similarly here, because the imaginary parts must add up to zero, you, in general, you can just take it to be negative, that at least one of the projectors must have a negative imaginary part, okay? So this is just to motivate that instead of looking at a general observable, we'll just look at a weak value for like a projector E, and without loss of so there's no loss of generality in when we just go to just looking at projectors instead of arbitrary Hermitian operators. And so now we look at this quantity. This is the weak value of a projector. And yeah, as I noted earlier, like it's just the numerator which contains the complex part, the imaginary part, and so that's what we'll focus on. And so again, the anomaly corresponds to either the real part going negative or the imaginary part. Okay, that's just like a rough, like how you go from the observable to the two projectors. Okay. So these were like the basic desiderata you need on the side of what the phenomenology of a weak value experiment is. When it comes to an anomaly, we've already been through an anomalous weak value. Now, so in much of my discussion, I was referring to quantum theory and talking about weak values relative to that. But eventually, we want our signature for non-classicality to be operational, in the sense that we want to be able to carry out the analysis in a way that doesn't appeal to quantum representations of the preparations, measurements, and transformations, but only appeals to the operational features that those preparations, measurements, and transformations have. Okay, so for that purpose, we need to motivate what is often called the framework of operational theories and ontological models. Right. So when we talk about an operational theory, what is it? It's in general just a prescription for assigning probabilities to outcomes. So here, P is some preparation, T is some sort of transformation you've put that preparation through, and then M is some measurement you do at the end, which has some set of possible outcomes, and one of them is K. K is, denotes an outcome of M. Okay, and so. So this is a prescription for how to assign probabilities if you carried out a certain set of procedures in the lab, some preparation, some transformation, and then some measurement. Okay, and if you can specify all of these for whatever you call your consider your operational theory to be, then you've sort of specified the space of predictions that the theory has. And when we talk about an ontological model, we are referring to an explanation of this data that you've seen. So recall that the primitives here were, you know, these abstract boxes. Like, you did not try to look inside the box. You were just interested in what the behavior of the box is, and the behavior is captured by this. But now you want to say something more. You want to say, why is it that the box is giving you these probabilities? Is there a realist account in terms of properties of the system that is passing between the boxes? So properties of the system is what is captured by this lambda, which is typically called a hidden variable. Or an ontic state, because it need not in general be hidden, so we'd call it an ontic state. And so we associate a preparation P with some distribution over ontic states, a transformation with some transition probability that, you know, that the transformation updates the ontic state from lambda to lambda prime, and then given this lambda prime, the measurement responds with some probability for this outcome. And then when you average over these lambda primes and lambdas, you recover the operational probabilities. So that's the sort of rough premise that you see this thing as a coarse graining of some underlying ontological model. Okay. Now, as I've stated, it's kind of trivial to construct such a thing because I've not really imposed any constraints on this, right? Like, it's you could just take your lambdas to correspond to essentially delta distributions on the preparations, and everything will work, for example. So we need to impose some restrictions on this ontological model. And the restrictions we want to impose should be such that they constitute some meaningful notion of what we take to be a classical account of the experiment, okay, a classical ontological model. And the restriction that we look at is non-contextuality, which is a certain inference from the operational description to the ontological description. And this inference is premised on this principle of the identity of indiscernibles, which is a phrase popularized by Rob of late. He's also written a long philosophical paper, if you want to read a philosophical paper by Rob on the identity of indiscernibles and the credentials of this sort of principle as a notion of, as a good principle for theory construction. So here we'll just motivate this as, if you're at all going to build an ontological model, like which constitutes your underlying theory, then it should be such that it respects this principle of the identity of indiscernibles. In this case, it's called non-contextuality. Okay, and what it means is this thing that, so firstly, you need some indiscernibles, right? So the indiscernibles here are preparation procedures. So these are two preparation procedures. And it turns out that no matter what interventions you do in your operational account of the theory, your probabilities, you cannot distinguish them. So for all measurements and intervening transformations, you get the same statistics for these two preparation procedures. So they are operationally indistinguishable. The data in the theory does not let you distinguish between them. There's no interventions you can do to tell them apart. So they're indiscernible in that sense. The same thing applies for the transformations. So for all possible preceding and following interventions you could do, you get the same statistics. And the same thing for measurements. Okay, for all preceding interventions, you get the same statistics. So that's when you call these two things operationally equivalent. So whenever two procedures are operationally equivalent, to reiterate, I repeat myself too much, but yeah. Things are called operationally equivalent when the data and the theory cannot distinguish them, okay? They're indiscernible. So when do we call them when do we call the ontological model non-contextual, right? So ontological model, now this is at the level of lambdas. So we call it non-contextual when it preserves the identity of these two indiscernibles, right? So it means that the representation of these indiscernible procedures in the operational theory should be the same in the ontological model, okay? That you represent them by the same distributions here, the same conditional distributions here, and same distributions here, okay? Is that clear for anyone who's not heard of this before? I'm assuming there's like a few people who don't know anything about it, right? Okay, because I spent a long time on this. Usually I just rush through it. Okay, weak value experiment. So now back to the, I've given you the, oh, I think it's my Gmail, doesn't matter. Okay, I don't know who's, it doesn't matter. So weak value experiment, we come back to the weak value experiment. So I describe the phenomenology of the experiment. I describe what I mean by non-contextuality. Now we come back to the experiment and we try to put those two things together, okay? So again, this three-stage process. We talked about ontology. So we'll associate some distribution with the preparation or distribution over lambdas. Now with the weak measurement, so this instrument essentially, you have to associate some probability that, so given this input of this lambda, there's some probability that it gives you some classical outcome x. And it updates the state or disturbs the state to some lambda prime, okay? So that's what we represent by this. And this once the state is disturbed to lambda prime, it goes to the final post-selection measurement, and you have this probability for the post-selection succeeding or failing. So we'll be interested in the success of the post-selection, okay? Okay, so what are the operational quantities of interest? So here I've just specified what the ontological representations of the operational description of the experiment look like. Now, the quantities of interest that in a weak value experiment that that we'll use to connect it to contextuality will be these. So firstly, we look at the probability of the weak measurement outcome x such that, let's say it's negative, okay? We will in general look at negative real or imaginary. So the thing is that this quantity will eventually turn out to be proportional to the weak value, Okay, so that's why it's of interest. It's of interest because when you look at the quantum description of this quantity, you'll see that it turns out to be proportional to minus the real or the imaginary part of the, depending on which experiment you're doing, whether you're observing the real weak value or the imaginary one. It turns out to be proportional to minus the weak value, real or imaginary part. And so in that sense, so that's why we're looking at this quantity. And the probability of a successful post-selection. So remember I said I'll use y equals 1 to denote successful post-selection. So the probability of, so this was your original preparation P star. So given this preparation P star, you followed it by this weak measurement. And you're asking for the probability that you saw some outcome x here, which is negative, and the probability that your post-selection, which you later on did, succeeds. Okay. So this is a summary of what you're interested in that weak value experiment, the quantity that you want to look at. Okay, so it's this joint probability. Now you can also think of this. You can essentially club the weak value weak measurement part in the post selection as like a single sort of sequential measurement. So in those terms, so because I'll show you like two different theorems which prove contextuality, one using transformations, one using preparations and measurement non-contextuality. So for the case of transformations, for the case of where I do not use transformations, but I only use preparations and measurements, this quantity is kind of like this way of thinking about it is kind of more useful. Okay, so here it's a sequential measurement, MW and MF. Now, the second quantity is simply the overlap, like quantumly it will be the overlap of a successful post-selection immediately following the pre-selection P star. So, you know, if your post-selection was phi and your pre-selection was psi, then this is the inner product of phi and psi mod squared, right? So this is that quantity. Operationally, this is what it is, right? In terms of the outcome of the measurement you're doing. Okay, so now we have all the pieces that we need. Well, almost all the pieces that we need, I think, to be able to state what Pusey's result looked like. Pusey claimed that anomalous weak values are proofs of contextuality, and that's in this paper here. And quantitatively, what it means, the statement, is that there exists some non-contextuality inequality that he derived, which essentially bounds this p minus that we just defined, like this probability of observing a negative value for x and a successful post-selection, by firstly the overlap between the pre-selection and the post-selection. And secondly, this quantity is the disturbance. This quantifies the disturbance that the weak measurement causes to the input state, the preselection. Okay, so this has to do with that. I mean, we'll come to it when we look at like a formal statement of the theorem. So this inequality is violated for a sufficiently large anomaly. Okay, and that statement has to do with the fact that if you do, for example, a quantum calculation of this quantity, then this piece here is the operative piece that will give you the violation, because when this thing is when this thing is positive, like when it's not anomalous, this quantity will be strictly less than this, okay, but when it's negative, that's when you have some possibility of a violation. And for a violation, you essentially need a sufficiently weak measurement. So S is the width of that initial wave packet thing. So you need it to be like sufficiently large that so that essentially this thing is sufficiently small, because this is sort of inversely related to 1 over S squared, I think. And then when you look at these, so all of these statements that I'm making come from like if you do a detailed calculation in the quantum formalism, okay? And so this violation happens for some large s whenever this quantity is sufficiently anomalous. Okay, that's the statement. So you need this piece to be large enough to see a violation. So I'm just making that statement. Okay, So this was the argument. No, this wasn't the argument. This was the result of the argument that PC made. I didn't really go through the argument. So let's just take this at face value. This was what he obtained. Now, when I say it has limitations, what do I mean? Like, what parts of this weak value experiment, in what sense do I think that this result is limited? I mean, do I, not only me, but Mac PUC and Matteo Lostaglia think that. This whole analysis is subject to these limitations, okay? Firstly, the post-selection had to be projective. This final measurement has to be like a projector. We want to relax this. We want to allow for sort of noisy post-selections. So you do not know that it's a projector. Secondly, it's not entirely clear from just PUC's paper that the operational equivalences that he used. So note that in order to use an assumption of non-contextuality, you need some operational equivalences in the experiment. And he used some operational equivalences that happen to hold in a weak value experiment, generically. It's not clear if they're really necessary to show the connection between anomalous weak value and contextuality. It could be that you could drop some and still get a proof of contextuality. That's entirely plausible, right? Like, because he didn't really show that they're necessary. Third, it doesn't show, for example, in some sense it dismisses the imaginary part of the weak value. It doesn't really sort of deal with that part. And I mean, it's sort of, there's a rough argument in that paper along the lines that since imaginary weak values appear in Gaussian subset of quantum theory, and people have studied them there, they, in general, you do not expect them to be connected to contextuality. That was the rough intuition for why they weren't looked at in PUC's paper. I had something to do with the information disturbance trade-off, which I think Matt would be better positioned to explain. The fourth limitation was that the analysis was intrinsically sort of in the continuum. So it required strictly speaking, it required an infinite number of operational equivalences to be verified. So there was an operational equivalence for every outcome x given the weak measurement. And so since it's a continuum of x's, like it's a real number, there's like an infinite number of equivalences you need to actually check to be able to strictly say that things are operationally equivalent. So this is like one of the those kinds of limitations. The fifth is that the non-contextuality inequality, it wasn't sort of, I mean, it proved the point, but it wasn't clear if it was like the tightest thing you could find or how unique it was, were there other inequalities there, and things like that, okay? And these are the limitations we try to overcome in our analysis of this problem. So what do we do? So we show, firstly, that you do not need a projective post-selection. You could have had a noisy POVM. And the inequality we obtain is robust to like the fact that your measurement is very noisy. And we provide like two different proofs of this thing. And both proofs are complementary to each other because they require different sets of operational equivalences to be verified. The preferable one is the one that involves just preparations and measurements. Because for a transformation, you'll have to check for every subsequent measurement the operational equivalence. The second result is that we show that the operational equivalences we use to motivate non-contextuality, they are indeed necessary. So if you dropped any one of the operational equivalences we use in our theorems, you could construct a non-contextual model relative to the other operational equivalences that will sort of reproduce whatever anomaly you're interested in. Essentially reproduces the phenomenology of the experiment. Okay. Third, surprisingly, there's like a connection between essentially the same argument goes through for the imaginary part of the weak value. The funny thing about this case is that it sort of looks like you're not really doing a very interesting measurement. The measurement looks like a trivial POVM, like your weak measurement. So it's kind of still like, I mean, I think it's not very intuitively sort of clear to me myself that how to read the contextuality in this in this case. I mean, you can see why it doesn't happen in the in like the non-contextual subsets of quantum theory, but yeah. So then the fourth thing is extension to a discrete pointer. So if you just use a qubit as a pointer instead of like a continuous like an infinite-dimensional system, you can prove the theorem in that case as well. And the argument, the structure of the argument is essentially the same that we use in the continuous case. It actually the calculations become a lot simpler because it's in just for a qubit. Also, it applies to like if you discretize the pointer instead of like looking at the continuum of outcomes. If you just bin the one side as call it minus like the negative values and all the other values plus, then it also applies to that situation. And finally, we actually implemented this algorithmic approach of David, Rob, and Ellie to examine like whether our inequality was a facet of the non-contextuality, the polytope of possible assignments to these quantities. Okay? And turns out it is. But there's kind of a subtlety. Like, if you want to actually claim tightness, there is... I mean, it's tight relative to the lemma we used to prove the inequality. But the assumptions in that lemma follow from the assumptions of non-contextuality. So, but we do not show the other way. So it's like we use like an intermediary lemma to obtain the inequality. And the assumptions of the lemma are consequences of non-contextuality, but it's not clear that non-contextuality is implied by those assumptions. So that's why the tightness that we show, I think that it's tight in general, but yeah. Okay, so when I was talking about these theorems, this is the form of these theorems. So suppose you had a non-contextual ontological model, and we'll invoke two kinds of operational equivalences that happen to arise in a weak value experiment. There exists a two outcome this thing, the outcome of the weak measurement, is operationally equivalent to a situation where you essentially did the projective measurement, like E is the thing that you were trying to weakly measure, okay? And then just like sampled, depending on the outcome of that, you sampled X according to some distribution QX, which has a median zero. So like the integral from minus infinity to zero of Q of X over dx is just half, okay? If that is true, so we require this thing to be the case, firstly, that the weak measurement is operationally equivalent to just doing the projective measurement and sampling x according to this distribution with median zero. This might look weird because I guess if I'm just like trying to motivate it operationally, but in the quantum calculation, this arises very naturally. Like this is associated with the amplitudes of that wave packet that I was initially talking about, the pointer thing. Secondly, we look at the channel, the overall transformation that the weak measurement implements, which means we integrate over all the classical outcomes x. So then, if you look at the overall channel that it implements on the input state, it turns out, and this d is what we call the disturbance probability, is really small in general in a weak value experiment. And so what this operational equivalence is saying is that transformation is most of the time doing nothing. It just giving you the same state. And some of the time it's implementing this disturbance channel. Okay? Okay, so you need these two operational equivalences. And if these two are satisfied and you invoke the assumption of non-contextuality relative to them, then you can show that this quantity that PUC was interested in that I earlier talked about is bound by an expression like this. So now recall that the expression that PUC had was this thing, like this PD here, right? And we've made a minor improvement to that in a sense, because there's this extra minus PF PD term. And actually, so we know that the inequality that PUC had was not tight, just because you can show a tighter one here. So far, And then we use the algorithmic approach to kind of claim the tightness of this thing. But that's relative to an intervening lemma, which follows from these assumptions. So tightness for non-contextuality itself, it's not sort of that clear. So what are the assumptions we've used? We've used measurement non-contextuality here and transformation non-contextuality here. So those are the two assumptions that we're used to obtain this. Okay. This is a second argument for the same sort of experiment, and now it differs from the previous one in one crucial respect, that we want to now assess explicitly in the experiment what, like, how good your post-selection is, okay? Some operational proxy for how projective it is, for example, okay? And to talk about like how projective it is, you need to do some, you need to implement it on some sort of preparations, right? Like, if it's a projective measurement, then there exist preparations that will make it perfectly predictable, namely just the eigenstates of the measurement, right? So since I'm stating it in operational terms, it may look a bit sort of abstract, but it just kind of follows. The intuition is that every projective measurement admits a preparation that makes it perfectly predictable. Okay. So now I'm talking about two preparations. So I label the first preparation by zero. So this is the probability with which we prepare this thing. So think of it this as like this is some sort of preparation like setting, some source setting. It has an outcome zero. And whenever you see outcome zero, you've prepared the system in some state. And that happens with this probability. And similarly, this is the other, this is another preparation that occurs with Q1, which is just 1 minus Q0. And you want to pick this ensemble, ideally, you want to pick it in a way that it maximizes the correlation with the post-selection outcomes. Okay, so post-selection has two possible outcomes. And you want to associate this with the successful post-selection and this with the unsuccessful post-selection. And you want to look at this correlation. Okay, this is the quantity. These are just the source measurement correlations between the post-selection. Source is this thing. So this is an ensemble of states. And measurement is the post-selection, so source measurement. And when I say correlation, I want their outcomes to sort of agree, which is just saying that, you know, if you take in the quantum case, this would just correspond to measuring the projector on the corresponding eigenstate. And similarly here, okay? And this quantity will, in general, will be 1 if the measurement was projective, but because typically measurements are noisy, it'll be less than 1. And so this is the sense in which I mean that it's a proxy for the quality of measurements. And any projective post-selection will admit some ensemble of preparations for which you can make this quantity 1, as long as you can prepare that thing. Okay, so this is the additional ingredient we've introduced besides what I've already talked about. And so now we can state a different theorem. And this theorem is, the first part is the same, namely that you can simulate your weak measurement by just like the strong measurement and this sort of X sampled according to some distribution. And given this, the sequential measurement that the two latter boxes are implementing, namely the weak measurement composed with like the final post-selection. So this has two outcomes, X and Y. So it's essentially like a joint measurement kind of situation, okay? So this defines this, when you coarse grain over X, that defines essentially some sort of a disturbed post-selection, right? Because you intervened with the weak measurement. Because this was just identity, this was doing nothing, then it's your regular post-selection. Because that's why we call it just MF tilde. Then the claim is that for this sort of disturbed kind of post-selection, there exists some PD, the disturbance probability, such that you can think of this thing is this effective measurement is operationally equivalent to just doing the post-selection with like a high probability, 1 minus PD, and with a small disturbance probability is just like some sort of disturbance measurement. Okay, this is the second operational equivalence we'll use. So note that this is not about transformations, this is about the measurement, like the post-selection measurement. And so for some two-outcome measurement MD, so these are assumptions of measurement non-contextuality in this theorem. And the third assumption we need is namely this, that so P star corresponds to that rho star, the pre-selection. Okay? So this requires the existence of another preparation P perp such that I can mix I can consider an ensemble of these. So Q star and Q perp are just like they add up to one, so it's an ensemble. And it should be such that this operational equivalence holds. Namely that if I sample this preparation with this probability, or this one with this probability, if I look at the mixture, the mixed preparation, that's operationally equivalent to the mixed preparation here. Okay? So this is an additional thing we need to be able to invoke the assumption of preparation non-contextuality. So measurement non-contextuality on its own will never give you a no-go theorem for non-contextuality. You either need transformations or preparations. Okay? At least preparations are needed. So we're doing the minimal that's needed outside of measurement non-contextuality here. So we'll invoke non-contextuality for preparations relative to this. And when we do that, we obtain an inequality of this form. Okay? So note the difference relative to the one that used transformation non-contextuality, which is this extra piece here. We're using fewer assumptions here, because in the transformation case, basically this thing has to hold not just for the post-selection measurement, but like any other measurement you could have done after the transformation, right? So the weakness of like so this inequality relative to these assumptions and the intervening lemma, well, relative to the intervening lemma, given these assumptions, lemma, and this inequality, relative to the lemma, this kind of is a tight inequality, but relative to non-contextuality itself, which gives you the lemma, it's not clear. That same statement holds here. Okay, and note that whenever this your projection is your post-selection is projective, namely the CS is one, then you go back to the inequality that MatPC had. Okay, so we recover whatever MatPC had in his paper. Yeah, this is just for, I guess, talks should have pictures, and since I don't have a lot of pictures, I just put one here. This is like the facet that corresponds to the inequality that we've been talking about. And all the other facets are usually just positivity type facets. They're not really non-contextuality facets. Like they're just like trivial because they don't tell you anything. At least they don't tell you about non-contextuality from anomaly in the weak value. Okay. The one that's related to the anomaly is this one. So in that sense, it's sort of a unique inequality. As I mentioned, we show that if any of, so for relaxing every operational equivalence, so for each of these, if you relax one of them and insist on the others and apply non-contextuality relative to the others, you can violate these inequalities. So all the operational equivalences are necessary for the inequality to hold, like in a non-contextual model. Okay. So that's something that has to be done by construction, and we provide some non-contextual model. They are a bit contrived, but they do the job, basically. They prove the point. OK, in summary, what makes these weak values contextual? Two facts, right? Like the first was that this operational equivalence that we had between the weak measurement and just a projective post-selection with some noise. Projective measurement with some noise sample according to that QX. So that's like the first operational equivalence. And secondly, that so in the first operational equivalence, you traced out the state. Like you didn't look at the post-measurement state, only the classical outcome. Here, and if you ignore the outcome, if you look at the channel, then the disturbance should be sufficiently small for you to be able to see a violation. Okay, so I guess you can take away at least these two things from this talk. Firstly, that if you have a sufficiently anomalous weak value, then it can signal contextuality as long as we have satisfied the operational equivalences in our theorem. So note that the role of these operational equivalences is akin to, so it may seem a bit ad hoc to say that why do you require these operational equivalences? What are the, so here we've essentially tried to identify certain features of the experiment that you do need to look at before you can go ahead and try to talk about contextuality, because it's akin to the case of like Bell experiments where you need no signaling before you can even say that Bell violations are interesting. Okay? So these operational equivalences are in some sense, the background desiderata you need to be able to meaningfully talk about contextuality. And since we've shown their necessity, we also know that, you know, it's not possible to really drop one of them. Secondly, the post-selection, yeah, I mean, you know, doesn't have to be projective. I didn't mention the discrete pointer theorem, but yeah, you can do it with just discrete pointers. It's tight relative to the caveat I've been like hopping on about. Yeah, imaginary part also I did not talk about, but it's a similar calculation and it also witnesses contextuality. Thank you.
So I didn't quite follow how you say you had two inequalities that you derived.
Mm-hmm.
The second one involved a term with CS.
Yes.
Here.
Yeah.
And so I think of that term as, in my mind, now I can take into account the non-projectiveness of that final post-selector measurement because CS measures the departure from projectiveness.
In a sense, yeah.
It'll go further away from one, further away from projective.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it were one, that would go to zero, and I would just have the old thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of feel like that's the one that, you know, if I've done the experiment poorly and my final post-selector measurement is very noisy, then I got a big extra term here, and
it penalizes you for.
It becomes harder to violate.
Yes.
But what I don't understand is the previous inequality that you gave, that didn't have that term. I thought that inequality was not for the projective case. Did I get that right? And I thought this was also supposed to be, you know, a noise robust inequality.
Yeah, because it just doesn't use the assumption of non-contextuality for the measurement, but it uses it for the transformation. Like it's noise robust in the sense that it just avoids using the operational equivalence
that
involves the post-selection.
Where it is in the other, and so the PD here somehow captures the noisiness of the post-selection. Is that the idea?
No.
Really noisy.
No, PD is not the post. No, there's no sort of signature of the post-selection here because, I mean, if you want to talk about the what happens after, so essentially this operational equivalence here.
Yeah.
Is like about this particular measurement following that transformation, right?
Uh-huh.
And we're looking at the operational equivalence that's satisfied by that measurement.
Uh-huh.
But if I insisted on this operational equivalence, the previous one, this one, then the same kind of thing should have to be true for every subsequent measurement you could have done, right? Not just the post-selection measurement.
Okay.
Like that's an implied operational equivalence of this. So I'm using many more operational equivalences here to obtain something like this. So I'm essentially using a lot more operational equivalences in terms of just the measurements, but of course that alone will not give you the inequality. It's the piece of transformation non-contextuality that doesn't have to do with just the thing with the implied measurement equivalences that essentially gives you a non-trivial bound. I don't know if that's explaining anything. What was the confusion?
I get the sense of how the operational equivalence is different, but what I'm still missing is, suppose I've done the experiment in such a way that the CS is almost zero, right? So it's very far from projective final measurement. This binary outcome final measurement is like almost trivial. It's like identity over two, identity over two, plus epsilon minus epsilon. So it's as far as you could get. I see how in the second inequality, that's going to make it almost impossible for me to to violate. How is that reflected in this earlier inequality?
I do see your question. So I think the only way that can come in is, so the quality of the post selection also has to do with this quantity, right? Like this BF. I mean, there has to be some way that when things are sufficiently noisy, that this quantity will be sufficiently large that the anomaly will not be enough to violate it. But I'm not able to like right away see it. Like, I'll have to think more carefully about how that happens. I mean, what I do know is that the inequality is valid, so that must happen somewhere in this expression.
Could it be?
And,
even though you use the term, the notation PD in both those, they really refer to different things. Like the PD in equation 22 here seems to have a different status from the PD.
I believe that they are the same. I think because it's the same calculation. It's just like
these
quantum
incorporate that final measurement, whereas the other ones exclude it. So it feels like it could be quite different.
Okay, I'll have to check this more carefully. But that's a good question because I was. The thing is, I was a bit surprised by this result because my original, the thing that I was interested in was the second theorem. Like, this is what I had proved with Matteo. And then we were telling Matt that, look, like, if you look at the ideal case when the measurements are projective, then we obtain an inequality that's slightly tighter than the one you had. Mm-hmm. So clearly you could have improved upon that inequality. Mm-hmm. So like even in the ideal case. And I don't know if that's what motivated him to just like show that. I think this was a result that he had, but he did not put in the paper itself, which was that using just transformation non-contextuality, you could get the same inequality. And so it just avoids talking about the post-selection measurement at all. And so this would be, so his version of noise robustification was to just like not use the assumption of measurement non-contextuality that requires a sharp measurement.
I see. So
he would call this a noise robust proof because it just uses these two things and there's no talk about it's noise robust like because it doesn't talk about the post selection basically. But the qualitative difference between the two is like it might be interesting to kind of parse this thing like a little better into like the parts of it that have to do with like the you know the implied equivalences for measurements and parts that do not come from there. Like that, because it's sort of like because transformation non-contextuality always kind of I keep away from it, like and it's always for like good reasons, right? Like, but like when it's being used, then like you know it's kind of a nice use case where like you know it might be interesting to look at what is it the conceptual differences between the two theorems, and I don't think. At least maybe it's clear to Matt. It's not so clear to me exactly how this thing comes about. So yeah, I don't have a better answer.
A basic question. So the paper by Chris Ferry and Joshua Gomes talks about how you can see weak values in a classical setting.
Mm-hmm.
And the one by Matthews and you talks about how it's related to contextuality, like anomalous weak values. So can you comment on their work? What does your work imply?
So the classical, it's classical in the sense that it just doesn't satisfy one of the operational equivalences we require, namely the one about like a low enough disturbance. Like you need this PD to be, you need this thing to be true for a low enough, small enough disturbance. And they require a huge disturbance, and you do not have this kind of operational equivalence. So it's classical in the sense that this thing holds, this one will hold, and you can violate the inequality because you didn't impose this one. So you know it's classical just because you didn't have this operational equivalence. So essentially the summary of it is that they didn't take into account a particular feature of the weak value experiment, namely this one. Relative to which you must like have non-contextuality. So basically, you know, you just don't have this equivalence, so you have no reason to talk about identity of these things. And so that constraint is lifted, and you can In fact, like one of the models that we talk about in the paper, like the one where we relax this thing and like you know preserve these other things, that'll be something similar in spirit to. Chris Ferry, for example. Like, we need to show that all of these things are necessary, right? Like, it's something like if you relax the no signaling assumption, you can violate Bell inequalities, there's no problem. It's a completely classical thing, right? It's the same sort of situation here. Like, there's a certain part of the phenomenology of the experiment that you need to confirm before you can say that contextuality plays a role or anything like that.
Ravi, can I add something to that?
Yeah.
So what I've just said is that essentially the Ferry-Coombs model is a contextual invariable model. But if your notion of classicality is such a low bar that just providing a contextual invariable model
it's not
something
a,
classical.
I don't think it'll be, I think it just fails to satisfy the equivalence, right?
But if that was my impression, that it has so much disturbance that you can't model it non-contextual.
Yeah.
Therefore, you could think of it as a contextual invariable.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Maybe.
But the point is that because we know that any quantum prediction can be modeled by some contextual invariable model, suddenly no quantum phenomenology becomes evidence of non-classicality. Like if you went by their standards, that constructing a contextual invariable theory is enough to claim classicality, then suddenly everything's classical. So that's sort of the reason why it seems like having a principle like non-contextuality is sort of important for having a non-trivial boundary between what's classical and what's not. Whereas the Combs theory is
it really a contextual model? Bar. Is it a contextual model? Is what I'm wondering.
I think so.
I thought it was. It's just that these. Okay. They just don't care about reproducing this part of the phenomenology. Is what I thought like was the case.
Like we know that the only way they could possibly reproduce it is by leveraging contextuality.
Yeah, so but they don't even look at that. Is what I'm saying. Like they probably don't even satisfy it. Like they don't satisfy this condition. I haven't checked it explicitly, but that's what my that was my understanding. Like, so I was saying something slightly different from what Rob just said, I think. But we should check, because as I said, I've only read two papers, this one and the one by Matt Pusey. Everything else I'm saying is based on whatever we've said in our paper. And I think we said something along these lines in our paper. I'll have to check Chris Ferry's paper too. Like. But I think, given the theorem, that's, sorry.
Any more questions just before Robin, there was a question.
Yeah. It's just, maybe it's detailed. You used the fact that in an anomalous weak value, you have the real part of your epsilon that is zero, is negative, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have the same form of the inequalities if you consider...
For the imaginary part?
One?
For what? For values greater than,
for example, instead of negative,
yeah, I mean, you need the, I mean, we didn't do that calculation, but basically,
it
should be the case, right? Like, I don't know if it'll be the same form of the operational quantity will be different, right? You won't be looking at p minus, but you'll be looking at the complement of that, so it'll just look different, I think. But yeah, conceptually, it'll be the same thing. Ellie, Rob.
Yes. The other question was, in Matt Pusey's original paper, any anomaly in the weak value, so any weak value outside the Huygens spectrum, was a proof of contextuality.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't quite understand what you're claiming about imaginary weak values. Like, presumably you're not saying any time there's an imaginary component to the weak value, that's
mm-hmm.
a proof of contextuality, because these results by Angela Carenza and others was an example where there was a non-trivial imaginary component, and yet it admitted of a non-contextual model.
Yeah.
So if it's not that, what exactly?
Yeah, it has to do with the amount of disturbance. Like in those models, you would never violate this inequality. I think okay, there's some subtlety about like the fact that they look here. We're talking about projectors, and they're talking about like the Gauss is the Gaussian quantum mechanics case. So that they're talking about those like quadrature sort of variables, right? And they have unbounded spectrum. And so there's like a subtlety having to do with when they have unbounded spectrum, like you expect that the disturbance, like here, that you'd incur will be quite high. And we have like a rough sort of argument in our paper for like, or we just look at like still a discrete spectrum, like, but we just look at the difference of the eigenvalues. And then it turns out that the disturbance is sort of lower bounded by a number that depends on what is the separation between the eigenvalues. And so if the separation is kind of like infinite, or like it's like an unbounded thing, then it looks like it's lower bounded by like half or something, which is quite high. Because you expect this PD in the quantum case to look like, I don't know, 1 plus e to the minus something by s squared, I think. Something like that, and this s is quite large. Sorry, what was I saying? Ignore what I said. So there is no contradiction. So firstly, there's no contradiction with like the results of Karanjai at all, because in their case, the inequality will never be violated, and the reason has to do with the disturbance being quite large. And so I mean, I guess it's, I don't know if that answers anything. Like,
well, if I,
like, if you can maintain a sufficiently low disturbance, and if you can talk about the imaginary part, basically you're doing momentum measurements on the pointer and to evaluate the imaginary part. And I don't know. I don't think I'm being very clear.
The definition of your P minus, the thing that appears on the left-hand side of the inequality, that was something about finding an anomaly, the probability of finding anomalous weak values. That included the probability of seeing something.
It was proposed. So here, because we're talking about position measurements, that it'll be proportional to the minus of the real part of the weak value. But if we're talking about momentum measurements on the pointer, then it's like the imaginary part is manifested differently than the real part. So when you're talking about that picture, then maybe I even have supplementary slides on that, because I think I kept some slides and maybe I have expressions for that.
So you have a different inequality for the case where the weak is a momentum measurement?
No, it looks similar. So this is the imaginary thing. So the difference is that this thing looks like a trivial measurement, because this looks like you're just like sampling from any distribution that, you know, negative with probability half. So it's like median zero type distribution. So this is the crucial difference between the two. Other than that, this disturbance has to be sufficiently low for you to be able to sort of violate this inequality. Like, the bound has to be sort of sufficiently small for this quantity to exceed it in some sense. I mean, it's still a bit of a conceptually, it's not entirely sort of clear to me, like why, like because here it does, it looks like you're not getting any information about the measurement that you wanted to do a week, like that you wanted to gain some information about, like it's giving you nothing about it because there's no dependence on that. So it's, I mean, mathematically, it's kind of, you can see how this inequality comes about from just non-contextuality. But conceptually, it's something that I have to understand. It has to do with the fact that it causes, like there is disturbance, but it doesn't lead to any information about the thing. Anyway, sorry.
So I think a few short questions. The version which doesn't look at the explicit sharpness of the measurement and your transformation architecturally really requires approximating the identity channel in sense, this does not give you any sort of experimental verification of the finite procedure, or you can verify this identity-like transformation operational with finite.
I don't think you can do it with finite number of tests, right? Because the realistic thing to do is the second one, basically the one with the preparation.
Nice.
Yeah, that's the realistic. I mean, that's the one that we did the whole. So actually, the thing we were saying about tightness of the inequality and things like that, that came from doing the algorithmic thing on the version with preparation, only preparations and measurements, because your algorithmic approach is for preparations and measurements, the non-contextuality thing. And then we needed like a sort of lemma which showed that if there exists a measurement non-contextual and outcome deterministic model for this experiment, like which is what Matt had in his original paper, then there also exists a measurement non-contextual and transformation non-contextual model. We used that thing to be able to claim the tightness in that case. So there's a small lemma that goes into arguing that.
Okay.
Yeah. It's hidden in the appendices somewhere.
Okay. And do you have this still a potential for unbounded quantum violation?
Unbounded?
Yeah, like the way that Aaron et al. Have this sort of 100.
Well, yeah, it depends on, because that 100 shows up in the piece in the calculation of that p minus. That is this, like, the weak value. Because when they say 100, they're referring to the weak value, right? So that will show up there, basically, right? Because depending on how large the weak value is relative to the disturbance, you can witness contextuality. So this is that part that goes to 100 and stuff, right?
And you're using the same quantum
repetition? Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, like, by unbound, I think unbounded, you just mean, like, largeness of this thing. And so, yeah, it can be, I guess, depending on how much you're, how few things you're interested in picking, post-selecting you. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Okay, well, let's thank Ravi.
Thank you.